We were just talking a little bit earlier, and I mentioned that one of my friends has a business, and his slogan of his business is, "We believe, we create, we make it so." And I always thought this is a very lovely little slogan, so I thought maybe tonight I can give a Dhamma talk on that theme. So this may go down in history as the first ever Dhamma talk that's given based on a company slogan. Maybe not.
Just do it.
Okay.
Just do it.
Maybe. Just do it. There's another one we could use. Yeah, the real thing, perhaps. I've given one on the real thing before. Anyway. We believe, we create, we make it so. And this kind of attitude that's and the kind of perspective that's caught and embodied in that those phrases has this kind of, to me, it has this kind of slightly childish and playful kind of sense of go for it kind of attitude. Something I find quite nice, quite delightful. One of the, you know, since the time I've been a monk for nearly 15 years now. In that time I've had very, very many challenges to learn many, many skills. Of course, the time before I was a monk, as you know, I was a musician, and you know, I was quite good at playing the guitar and stuff, but I didn't have a lot of other kinds of life skills, and so I wasn't really interested in them. And so I've had to learn how to do so many kinds of things, you know, writing letters and dealing with people in all kinds of ways, and doing Dhamma talks and writing books and learning all about building. How do you use an angle grinder? What is an angle grinder? You won't believe this, but when I first arrived at Bodhinyana Monastery, Amanda's asked me, "Have you seen the angle grinder?" And I said to him, "What's an angle grinder?" All of these kinds of things, learning how to organize conferences and blah blah blah, all this stuff. And I sort of approach it in a spirit of fun and play, and just trying it out and seeing how it goes. I don't let it become a burden for me. Occasionally things become burdensome, but for the most part it's just, I do it with a sense of play and a sense of, you know, just doing things that are good and enjoyable and so on. And what I've found in doing that is a sense that this kind of the attitude that you bring to a thing really does determine the outcome. That we say we really do tend to create the world that we live in. And I've seen that very often with people. And I mentioned this example a few times to people here, and just to tell the story. But one time when I was living in Thailand with a group of monks, and we had a group of monks there, we had a very nice rains retreat, and all the monks got along very well, and we were all very good friends. And at the end of the rains retreat, the place we were staying in was this little hermitage, and it was a bit run down, hadn't been looked after for a few years. There was problems with the hall, the wood in the hall was cracking and stuff, and there were the paths had washed away, and there was different kinds of problems. And so we sort of said, okay, let's fix these problems. And we took it upon ourselves to repair. We did things like repairing the road, a bit similar to the work we're doing at the road. It's working with Santi at the moment, bringing in gravel and making several hundred meters of road by hand. It was mainly the workers from the village who did that. But we sort of organized it, making a new bridge across the creek, fixing up various kutis and things, fixing up the main hall, all these kinds of things. And especially at the end of the rains retreat, we really worked incredibly hard, as probably the hardest physical labour I've ever done in my life. And we literally just worked until we were just jelly. And one of the monks who was there is a very good friend of mine, Venerable Satimanto, and he's this kind of beefy American lawyer. And he's done everything in his life. So, you know, oh, we've got to renovate this house, you know, the sala, we've got the main hall, we've got to do all this carpentry and work. And he said, oh yeah, I used to renovate houses for a living, and we've got, you know, this particular carpentry work or something. Oh yeah, I used to make antique furniture. I said, make antique furniture? Yeah. Yeah, you make it, and then you smash it with bicycle chains and stuff like that. And, oh, okay. And then we had to make this bridge across the creek. The old bridge got washed away in a flood. And when I say bridge, it was a couple of logs across the creek. The previous time I'd been there, we'd actually put the logs there. And that was quite funny because we were carrying the logs down. And of course, one of the log, you know, it's like as big as a telephone pole. And it kind of says a bunch of guys, the monks, and also the guys from the village. And then the log slipped and fell on the leg of one of the villagers, pinned him into the mud with this huge log on his leg, and squashed his leg into mud. Everyone killed themselves laughing. That's how people do it. The more dangerous it gets, the bigger laugh you have. Anyway, so that got washed away by the flood, so we made a new one. We decided to make it out of steel. So we got this guy in the village who had this little kind of pokey little welder thing. Got some steel together and so everyone was studying Nanto. So we had to make this bridge. He said, oh yeah, I spent 2 years making nature trails for the national parks in the States. I said, okay. And then we had to do this landscaping. And he said, oh yeah, I've got a degree in landscaping. So poor old Sarimanto, he has a hard time in the monastery because he's so useful for so many things. Anyway, and so we did all these things. We had another monk as a friend of ours, and he was exactly the opposite kind of character, and he was kind of quite, sad and lacking in confidence and so on. And so every time we would try to do something, and we'd have like these two kind of dialogues coming on one side, this kind of can do, yeah, right, let's go and let's get it, and it's never going to work. Oh, come on, this is just right, this is not going to work. Oh, this is fantastic, this is really going to go. Oh, no, this is really horrible. Oh, look at that, it's just dreadful, it looks worse. And the more and more we went, the more we did it, things happened inevitably, you know, actually the work got done, the things got fixed up, and time again we would do these things and really try hard. We had a lot of things we had to do. Had very little money, no budget, we had to just really work hard to get this stuff done. And then eventually the other monk just couldn't handle it anymore. He basically just had a kind of mini breakdown almost. Not really a breakdown, but just withdrew into his kuti. Wouldn't come out of his kuti for 2 or 3 days. And I just walked over to his kuti, you know, and just knocked on the outside. He wouldn't even open the door. He said, yeah, I'm fine. He was going to stay there and be depressed for a couple of days because it was so difficult for him to cope with the fact that his gloom and doom was actually wrong. And that it was, you know, again and again and again, we were showing that with enthusiasm and energy and application, that all of these things can be done, and the work can be accomplished. So that was very interesting for me to see that kind of dynamic, and that kind of difference. So, you know, I mean, of course, everyone, each side of that equation has their own dukkha. So, in terms of spiritual development, then each side of those things has its own suffering. Yeah, I mean, obviously the kind of the can-do, you know, gung-ho approach has its own kind of thing. You become attached to your identity as the doer. Yeah, you think I am the doer, I am the controller, I am the maker, and that's another set of conceit and arrogance and all of those kinds of things. And then we've got to deal with that. Okay, and similarly with the you know, the other side, if we're following the kind of way of cynicism and depression and so on, then that has its own kind of dukkha. So these are just two, you know, these are just different character types. That's all, personality types. And, you know, each one has its, you know, upside and downside and can be good for different kinds of things. But in terms of actually, managing and, you know, developing a monastery or whatever, then obviously having a positive attitude is much more helpful. And I was thinking about this in the context of faith, and you know, the slogan from the company, we believe, we create, we make it so. It starts out, we believe, and in Buddhism too, belief or faith, saddha, is the beginning. Like the dawn, the Buddha said that faith is like the dawning of the Noble Eightfold Path. With faith, we can really overcome so many things. And it's very sad, it's very unfortunate that in modern Buddhism that faith has got a bit of a bad name. And of course we're so used to having faith be made to be the be-all and end-all of religions. We're a bit sick of religions that just tell us to believe and so on. Then we come to Buddhism and we're relieved that it tells us, yes, we can inquire, we can, and so on and so forth. So that's all good, but that sometimes leads to a denigration of that simple faith and devotion. And of course, traditionally in Buddhism, when the Buddha talked about faith, he mentioned specifically faith in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And as we chant, each time we have the meeting, we chant the Itipiso Bhagava and the recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And so these are the things which we go for refuge. Okay, things to which we go for refuge. They form a very powerful and beautiful umbrella and haven for us, place of shelter and a place of safety. And so it's very well worth taking the time to reflect on what these things mean and how they are so powerful for us. If we think of the Buddha, you know, we have the historical Buddha, we have the idea of a young man called Siddhartha Gautama who went forth and practiced for many years, realized enlightenment in Bodh Gaya 2,500 years ago, and then spent 45 years teaching before he attained Parinibbana in Kusinara. And we have various descriptions of him, both physical descriptions, descriptions of his conduct, and of course the records of his teachings and his ideas. And the teachings and ideas that he had, yes, on the one hand we can think of that in terms of philosophy and so on and so forth, but actually is presented in the context of living dialogues. It's the Buddha speaking to the bhikkhus or the bhikkhunis or to the laymen, the laywomen, the Buddha speaking with various people who come to ask him questions, or him going to other people and asking them questions. And the discourses, it's quite interesting that, you know, you can use all of the text critical arguments and so on that you like and look at the processes of redaction and so on and realize that the texts have been edited and blah blah blah. But at the end of the day, there's some kind of absolutely magnetic personality which still shines through that. It doesn't come from nowhere. It's not just a character that you can invent in a book. And there's something about some of those personal moments. For example, like when the Buddha, very famously one when the Buddha attended to the sick monk. Or when, you know, the little moments like when he went to the see the wanderers of other sects and they asked him what he was teaching, and he said, "Oh no, I'd like to hear what your teaching is first." And then they were so amazed that you know, even given when he was invited to expound his own ideas, preferred to listen to the ideas of others. And so these kinds of little moments and the kind of the sometimes slightly ironical kind of sense of humour that we get in certain situations, like for example when the fellow comes to him and says, "I have this following view, nothing whatsoever is pleasing to me," and the Buddha says, "Well, is that view itself pleasing to you?" He comes back so quick, yeah. And when the monk comes to him and the monk says, "Lord, the Blessed One has spoken in many ways in praise of the cutting off of the cords of sensual desire. Well, here I have, I've castrated myself." And the Buddha's response was, "You silly man, you've cut off what should have been left and left what should have been cut off." So these kinds of things, it's not as Richard Gombrich, the great Pali scholar, said these kinds of things is not what would be invented by a committee. Right? Committees don't crack jokes. Yeah? And so in these kinds of things, you actually see something of the Buddha's personality shining through. this is almost kind of slightly naughty sense of humour, yeah? And so, you know, just to think about that, just to think, why is there something about the Buddha, that idea, that word the Buddha, it's almost, you know, after 2,500 years, it still has this incredible resonance for us. You know, even people today, if you want to say someone's, you know, reached some kind of highest attainment or ultimate spiritual enlightenment, you still say, oh, they're a living Buddha or something like that. In comparison with the Buddha himself, that other people are also good. You know, Nagarjuna was said to be like a second Buddha or something like that. So, you know, in a way you're exalting Nagarjuna by comparing him to the Buddha, but in the same time you're also saying, well, you know, the Buddha's the standard by which others can be measured. And that's remained the case. And it's remarkable that after 2,500 years, how little negativity or baggage has assembled around the Buddha's name. You know, if you think like the associations or the connotations of the word Buddha today, it's almost entirely positive. And there's almost nothing that we can say that's actually, you know, in terms of our general or just ordinary social connotations of the word, which has anything negative about it. And so this man, this personality, has shone down through the ages with a power which is still living and which we still feel in ourselves. And we can look around at all the things that we have here. I mean, most obviously the Buddha image, but even more so the place, the people, the our chance to come here and practice. All of these things have descended from the Buddha, and everything looks back to him. When we try in our own little way to correct and reform some aspects of Buddhism that comes down to us, we do so by reference to the Buddha himself. We don't do so by saying, no, the Buddha was wrong, therefore we have to do things better than him, because it's not the case. We do so by saying that the institutions and customs and practices that have grown up around Buddhism have in certain respects not lived up to the standard that the Buddha himself set, and therefore we have to change it to get back to and to try to aspire to that spiritual height which the Buddha himself attained and which he shared with us. And so we think about this activity of the Buddha, you know, every day. You know, it's every day it's like teaching and travelling and it's something which you can't. I remember when I first started reading the suttas that I was a little bit disappointed. I thought it was a bit kind of banal, or a bit, not banal, but a bit kind of bland, or not as extraordinary as I'd been hoping. But there's something. One of the things about the suttas is that the extraordinariness of the Buddha's personality is not something which manifests all at once. It's not something which kind of is necessarily immediately grabbing, but it's something which emerges very, very slowly over a long time, and which, you know, just seeing how the Buddha responded and reacted in so many different circumstances with so many different people, and just seeing the purity and the beauty of his composure, his wisdom, his compassion, that he would just react so beautifully all the time with everybody, and in each case was so appropriate. And as he himself taught, the different ways of answering questions, sometimes to answer a question with silence, sometimes with a counter question, sometimes giving a detailed answer, sometimes giving a short answer, and so on. And so he's constantly engaging with people. He's never cutting them off, never demonizing them. Yes, he would criticize when it was necessary. Right? He wouldn't just go around criticizing because he had a fault-finding mind. But the Buddha said very, very clearly, you should criticize what is worthy of criticism. You should praise what is worthy of praise. So he did not say you should be equanimous in all circumstances. He said you should criticize what's worthy of criticism. And so he would do that, you know, when it was necessary, and then he would criticize. But for the most part, he wouldn't. For the most part, he would just teach the Dhamma and try to raise people up to aspire to what is beautiful, to aspire to what is good, to lift their minds up out of the morass of defilements and then aspire to what is very pure and very beautiful. When he did criticize others, he would usually do it by not by directly accusing or blaming anyone, but by questioning them, engaging them, and drawing, as is known as the Socratic method. And Buddha would do exactly the same thing, which is to draw out the implications of a person's views. So, for example, when he was dialoguing with the Jains, then he would ask them questions about their own views and then draw out implications of those things. So rather than simply opposing their doctrine, he would try to show perhaps internal problems or inconsistencies with their own teachings. And so again, this is just showing his intelligence and compassion in the way that he went about doing these things. And so there's just something unique, something irreplaceable about this personality of the Buddha. And if we think about it, you can think how extraordinary it is that in such a long time, remember that all of us who are here, and of course most obviously the monks and nuns, but even more so, even also including the lay people, we're all basically Buddha junkies, and we're all basically trying to be the Buddha in one way or another. Yeah, we're all trying to copy him in one way or another. We're not necessarily literally saying I'm going to copy everything he does, but in some way we have this idea of the Buddha in our mind and we're trying to live up to those standards. And millions of people have been doing that for 2,500 years and no one has succeeded. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? So many people have tried to equal the Buddha's practice, his wisdom, his compassion, his enlightenment, and nobody has done it. And within Buddhism, everybody, even the most respected masters with the greatest meditation and the deepest wisdom, they will bow down in homage to the Buddha, and they will say, for myself of such little wisdom, I pay homage to you of vast and endless wisdom. And so this is the inspiration that we take for the Buddhist religion. It is this vast, deep, limitless wellspring of wisdom which has fueled and provided the spiritual sustenance for millions and millions of people for thousands of years, and is not looking like running out anytime soon. And so when we have faith in the Buddha, this is what we recollect, and we have faith in this ongoing spiritual nourishment. And so the second object of faith is the faith in the Dhamma. Of course, the Dhamma meaning most directly the teaching spoken by the Buddha. In that sense, again, just to reflect on the extraordinary nature of what we have. We have the teachings of a single man, thousands and thousands of discourses and teachings in different places and so on and so forth, collected by this amazing, massive kind of collective effort of the Sangha in the years following the Buddha's passing away, assembled into this unprecedented library of teachings. There's nothing remotely like that in the rest of Indian history. In the Brahmanical tradition, you have an evolution of texts which have evolved from long before the Buddha, which is the collections of many different teachers over a long, long period of time, over 1,000 years of teachers have been collected, little bits and pieces that were remembered from different people, but nothing even vaguely like such a massive collection from one person. Similarly with the Jaina scriptures, that they were only collected and written much, much later, and show obvious signs of being a later composition, as the Jaina tradition itself admits. And so, again, to think that there must have been something to that. There must be a reason for it. It doesn't spring out of the view. It's not just a sort of cynical plot or something like that. It's actually something the most rational and straightforward explanation for that is very simply that the Buddha's personality and his teachings did in fact inspire a massive and unprecedented outpouring of teachings, which there was a huge amount of effort put into remembering and preserving and organizing and passing down. This, to me, is the most rational explanation for these things. And when we look at the Dhamma, then similarly to the personality of the Buddha, that it's something which is not necessarily immediately apparent. We look at the teachings, in some ways they can seem to be, certain parts of them can seem to be quite dry, or maybe they seem to be simplistic in some cases, or else perhaps obscure in others. In certain cases we might find some things are spoken of in great detail that we think are maybe a bit irrelevant, and other things which we would love to hear more about are glossed over very briefly, and so on and so forth. So yes, if we want to find fault, we can do so. But the more we get familiar with that, and I've been studying these things very deeply, very seriously for 15 years now, then they have this kind of magnificent serenity to the teachings that's found in the Pali Canon and within the similar literature. It's very kind of unhurried. Unhurried, this kind of patience and this kind of sense of reasonableness, which is not to be underestimated. You know, if we compare the teachings of found in the suttas with, for example, some of Jesus' sayings in the Gospels, or say with some of the things we maybe find in certain of the Upanishads and other things, we maybe find that sometimes those things seem more vivid. And Jesus' teachings, the best parts of his teachings in the Gospels are very vibrant, very alive, and the teachings in the suttas are maybe a much more kind of smooth, much cooler, more distant, and so it's a bit difficult to engage with them necessarily in the same way. But more again, the more we immerse in that, then that we see that there's a certain the compassion and the metta that's found in those teachings is very mature kind of compassion and metta. It doesn't let itself get swept over by emotional extremes, so we don't find the favouring and the opposing. We don't find the same kind of obvious passion in the Buddha's teachings, but we find this little bit by little bit, just going little bit by little bit, this kind of reasonableness and this constancy of it, on and on and on, after so many years and so many times, so many places, so many circumstances, so many things, and always this kind of just rolling on, this gentle rolling on of this very kind of reasonable, very appropriate, very profound teachings. And so the more we engage with these things over a long period of time, the more again we get faith in those things. And as you know, I'm not somebody who believes that faith means we have to insist that all of these teachings were literally spoken by the Buddha in exactly the form we have them today, and so on and so forth. This is not, in my view, this is not true faith. This is based on fear, and fear is actually opposed to faith. And fundamentalism, the insistence that the teachings are all exactly the same as spoken by the Buddha, is based on fear of reality. And fear of reality is the enemy of faith. So if we have that real faith in the Dhamma, we know that no matter what we do, no matter how we investigate, how we inquire, how we compare, how we analyze, take apart, deconstruct, whatever, then the Dhamma remains and the Dhamma shines forth. And so this faith in the Dhamma is something which we don't take for granted. It's not just something which is given to us or which we either have or we don't have. It's something which we cultivate as an active aspect of the path. We cultivate it quite deliberately through our continued on and on gentle application to these things. And so, you know, we have the Rains Retreat coming up, and I would encourage you to do as I've always done, especially in the early years as I was a monk, was to choose for the Rains Retreat usually one book of suttas. You maybe choose the Majjhima Nikaya, or perhaps I would often choose one of the shorter books, maybe the Udana or the Sutta Nipata, and just keep that in my kuti for the rains, and just read that, like maybe one short sutta, a page or two each day. Just to have that much input and just keep that daily little bit of contact with the Dhamma, giving yourself plenty of time to digest them. In addition to that, the other way of engaging with the Dhamma through faith is, of course, through chanting. And again, as you know, I've encouraged you all to learn the suttas, and especially the most important thing is to learn the prose suttas, as they are easier to remember and easier to understand. And so again, I would encourage all of you to find a few suttas that you like, that you're interested in, and then get hold of the Pali of those suttas. If anyone wants any help with that, I'm of course most willing to help. If there's a particular sutta you like and you'd like to get hold of the Pali for it, then and then during the Rains Retreat, just learn that off by heart, chant it every day. Really learn it by heart, yeah? So it's not just thinking about it, but it's learned by heart. So third of the three objects of faith is the faith in the Sangha. And of course, again, Sangha has a straightforward, concrete meaning, as is the ordained disciples of the Buddha, those who have taken the ordination as bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, and samaneras and samanerins, and sikkhamanas, of course. So again, this is something which is not at all obvious, because often, if you look at the individuals within the Sangha, then maybe they're not all that well practiced. Okay, maybe they've got their own defilements or their problems, and you know, leaving aside kind of obvious problems with corrupt or badly conducted Sangha members, but even as far as good monks and nuns go, well, I mean, they may be, you know, virtuous people and sincere and so on, but they may still have defilements and they still may struggle with their meditation or whatever it may be. And so we also have, of course, the Arya Sangha, which also one should have faith in, is the enlightened disciple. So this kind of has two aspects. And of course, the noble Sangha, who have realized the various stages of enlightenment, may be ordained or may not be ordained. And of course, we never know who they may be unless we have psychic abilities of our own. But the object of faith in terms of the practical or the devotional side of Buddhism is the ordained Sangha. This, right, it's very interesting. This kind of provides this completely extraordinary institutional or social continuity, just as the Dhamma, the written texts, provide a continuity and a connection between us and the Buddha and what he taught. And the Sangha does that in a living sense. Again, it's completely unprecedented, the success of the Sangha on a worldwide basis. There's simply nothing else which is remotely comparable. If we think of, well, what were similar things happening in that time, 2,500 years ago? Well, there was the priests of Isis, who were a hereditary caste, who were the worshippers of the goddess Isis and so on. Well, they were quite popular around 2,500 years ago. We don't hear much of them these days. The Druids, perhaps, also perhaps not so successful these days. There were in India quite a lot of different orders of religious peoples. The Brahmins, of course, were around, and they were around long before the Buddha, but that is not an organized institution as such, but more of a social class. The Jains had their monastic order. It's not sure how organized and that was in the time of the Buddha, but in any case they have had limited success in spreading themselves anywhere outside of India, although they did remain in India, so they also have been a very successful religious movement, but not very much smaller than the Buddhist one. And so this Buddhist monastic order is quite unprecedented in many ways. There is still something, and I think we've all felt that, there is still something very beautiful about the idea of having the Sangha around and the idea of being able to connect, serve, be a part of, or be associated with that community. And there's just something special about it. I remember even when I did my first retreat at Wat Ramphung in Chiang Mai, and after I came out of the retreat and I would be in the markets perhaps shopping or something like that in the mornings, and I'd see the monks going for alms round, and I'd immediately go and try and get something to offer and come and offer, and of course they were very surprised to see a Western, you know, young Western man coming and offering dana. They probably hadn't seen that before. But there's this kind of instant recognition and response. And of course one of the very beautiful things about the Sangha is that whatever we do is not for us personally. And this is part of what we've renounced. So when we come here to this monastery and we put such a lot of effort into developing this monastery, we don't do it as a personal thing. You know, since we've been here, we've spent a lot of money and done a lot of work, do a lot of building and development and all kinds of things. And none of it is in the slightest bit personal. As you all know, my own intention for these, for development we're doing in the house and so on, is to, as soon as the time seems right, to give this to the nuns and let them, you know, have this as their property and use it as they see fit. If nothing is done as a personal thing, and everything we do is as a service to the Sangha. And so there's something very, very beautiful about this, just this thing of offering to the Sangha. Of course, in some of the Buddhist suttas, it would say that the Sangha is the ideal field of merit. And it's relating to this Indian idea where the giving of offerings would lead to a good or a wholesome result. So we get basically, if you give, it's a good karma, and you get happiness as a result of that. And so the rewards from giving are usually analysed in terms of three things. One is the giver, second is the gift, and the third thing is the recipient. And the more pure or the more wholesome each one of those three things is, then the better is the results that we get from that merit. And so one of the things that it says in there, which I disagree with very strongly, it says that if you offer to a Sangha, even a Sangha who all they do is just wear a strip of cloth around their neck, yellow cloth, and that's all that's left, and apart from that they're not really well properly behaved or practicing at all, then even that is a gift that's greatly virtuous. And I don't believe that, and that's been refuted, I think, quite successfully by Venerable Analayo, by reference to both the comparison with other versions of that sutta and also by things which the Buddha said elsewhere. And in fact, the normal position which the Buddha said in the suttas is that one gives to a Sangha who's practicing well. And it's the very fact that one is supporting, not that it's simply a symbolic offering to whoever happens to be there, but that one is, by giving and serving and helping, one is supporting that spiritual practice and development of the Eightfold Path, and that ultimately the realization of Nibbana. And that is what's very so virtuous and so wonderful. And by giving and supporting in that way, we create the conditions for our own realization of Nibbana. And so this is one of the reasons why the Buddha said this merit is incalculable, it's immeasurable. It's not just giving for a limited purpose and a limited use, but it has an unlimited purpose and an unlimited use. That offering to the Sangha will then spill over, and benefit so many other people. And you can see this is not just a theory or an idea. You can see that very obviously anywhere you look. For example, if you look in Perth at the Buddhist Society of WA, and we all have some idea of how successful that's been, and the many offerings and so on that's gone into that, and the support from the lay people there over many, many years, and how all of that kindness and all of that generosity and all of that support has benefited so many thousands of people, both there and also overseas. They've been able to do charity works, they can do all kinds of things. That just keeps on overflowing. It becomes like a fountain of goodness which is spreading out all over the world and just keeps on overflowing and overflowing and overflowing, and becomes this magnificent well of goodness and happiness and joy for so many people. And so this is why, in a very practical sense, these offerings to the Sangha can be of such great benefit. Of course, we shouldn't give too much to the Sangha, because if you give too much, then the Sangha gets corrupt. And this is something to watch out for. And sometimes if the Sangha gets corrupt, then it becomes a waste of time. And there's no point in just pouring money into monasteries for the sake of it, and just building things just for the sake of building them. We should be careful. We build a monastery for the sake of supplying conditions that are supportive for meditation and Dhamma practice, and that's all. We don't waste our money on other things. That's all we're here for. That's all we do. So the funds which come in supply those needs for the Sangha to that extent, and this is why I insisted that we put in our constitution that if we have excess money, that should be given to charity. If the Sangha has enough, if we've built enough facilities, we've got enough that we need to practice, then we don't just accumulate money and then start to build various projects just because we want to, but we give it away to people who need it. And in that way we can maximise the benefit and the effectiveness of the donations which have been entrusted to our care. And so by helping to support the Sangha, then we create the conditions for incalculable good things to happen. The people here who are coming to train, I know that, you know, all the monks and nuns here are really hopeless, okay? Now, and we all know that they're really stupid and got full of defilements and all of these things. What do you expect, all right? But there's hope. There is hope if you have faith and if you can nurture them. And you look at, you know, you can say you're great teachers, you know, like Anton Brahm and so on and so forth. And they also were like that one day, okay? And they also had all of these kinds of defilements and so on that you see in all of the young monks and young nuns, okay? And but they practiced. And they practiced well for many years, and they overcame these things, and then they become this wellspring of merit and goodness. It just pours out over the world. And that's what can happen from here. And this is what my vision has always been since we started this place. This is what we're here for. We're here to create enlightened beings. We're here to create people of wisdom and of compassion and of kindness. And we're here to provide those facilities that can support the realization of real Dhamma, not this kind of fake, trivialized, commercialized Dhamma, the real thing. We're here to do the real thing. And I will stay here and do whatever I can to make that possible until we have people here who are really doing it. And you all know that since we've been here, that we have seen examples of that. You know, leaving aside my silly jokes, but I actually have incredible respect for all of the monks and nuns here and for what they've done. You know, we think about where these people have been and what they've done. You know, we look at people like Venerable Tapasi here, who came as such a young boy and has grown so much and matured so much in the Dhamma. You know, someone like, say, one of our first monk, Venerable Mahesi, who, you know, just came here and just kept wearing out his walking meditation path and just, you know, just did that whole thing And so many people have been so dedicated, and I could say similar things about everybody who's here. I don't want to just pick out one or two, but I don't have time to praise everybody fully. But everybody has all of those beautiful qualities and virtuous qualities. And over the years, with time, with some space, with some help and with some support, we can create something that's incredibly beautiful and incredibly profound, and we'll have a major input and flow on to all around, whether in the local area, whether in the Sydney and the region here and internationally. These things will just keep on flowing out. And so this is something that's really important, that we bear that in mind. We're not looking at what's happening this week or next week or this month or next month. We're looking at growing a spiritual community, a spiritual sangha for the future of humanity. Nothing less. That's our vision. That's what we're doing here. That's worth anything. That's worth really putting our lives on the line for. And that's worth really having some devotion towards. So this thing of faith and developing faith for the Triple Gem, the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, is opposed to fear. And one of the suttas about that, where the Buddha taught the Itipiso teaching, was actually a sutta where Sakka was going into war to fight the Asuras, and he fixed on his standard, his flag. He fixed the flag of Sakka, and he said, if you're facing the Asuras and you're getting fearful, then look to my flag, and that will fill you with courage. And then the Buddha's comment was, well, Sakka himself is still not free of fear. He himself is not free of unwholesome qualities. And so when you're looking at his flag, you can't really be filled with courage, because he himself is scared inside himself. So if you want to be really free of fear, then remember the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, these things that are actually free of fear. And if you have faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, then you'll be free of fear. And so this is why we kind of develop this recollection. Fear is always looking to the negative consequences in the future, what might go wrong. And so we're always worried about what might go wrong, and we're always saying, this might happen, or that might happen, or this might be bad, or that might be bad. And we create this fear, this negative emotion, and out of that negative emotion, negative things come. And the opposite of that fear is faith. And faith looks at the future and says, what can happen? What can we build? What can we create? What can we can make it so? And that will create a wonderful, powerful, brilliant, happy world in the future. If we will allow ourselves to follow that, not follow the voices of cynicism, of negativity, and the things we can do, and look at what we've accomplished since we've been here, and look at what people have done in terms of bringing donations to the monastery, look at the incredible hours of work that all the people here have done to help build the monastery and look after it, maintain it, all the acts of kindness and consideration that have gone into this place, and all of the care, the wisdom, the compassion that everybody here has been putting into it, and this is building this up. And so this is that basis of true faith. It's not a faith in something that's unreal. It's not a faith in something that's just an imaginary construction. It's a faith in what's actually real, what's actually happening. And so by doing this and having this faith, we create the world that we live in. We create our own reality. So again, this is the slogan I started out the talk with. We believe, we create, we make it so. And that's exactly how it is. From our beliefs, we create things, and we make that world that we then live in. So this is my little talk for you this evening on faith. I offer that to you for your reflection.